I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Robert Budd joins me again, better known as Lucky Budd. He is a historian who has spent many years already digitizing oral histories in British Columbia, whether it's oral histories of the Nisga'a First Nation or some of the CBC's archives. He's done great work in preserving what would have otherwise gotten lost. His new book is called Echoes of British Columbia, Stories from the Frontier. It's a great collection of oral histories presented in a fine book that's accompanied with CDs of actual recordings Mr. Budd recovered from the Provincial Archive. The recordings come from nearly 1,000 interviews totaling nearly 3,000 hours of material conducted by CBC radio journalist Imbert Orchard. Between 1959 and 1966, Mr. Orchard, who died in 1991, traveled the province to talk to some of British Columbia's pioneers. The conversations are remarkable and add so much to the understanding and memory of this place. Lucky Budd joins me now. This book is a follow-up to his first book, Voices of British Columbia, which was published in 2010. He's the co-author with Roy Henry Vickers of the popular Northwest Coast Legends series, which has yielded two best-selling books, Raven Brings the Light and Cloudwalker. The website for more is at memories2memoirs.ca. Some of Imbert Orchard's interviews have been featured on CBC Radio's North by Northwest as part of the Voices of BC series. Incidentally, Cheryl McKay will join Lucky Budd this Wednesday, the 3rd of December, at 7 p.m. at the Book Warehouse on Main Street for the book launch. That's at 4118 Main Street. It's a great shop. I've been there. I've been in there from time to time, just this past weekend, actually, and it's a great addition to the neighborhood. The book is published by Harbor Publishing. Please welcome back to the Plant on the Line program in Victoria, Lucky Budd. Mr. Budd, good morning.
Good morning, and I actually really enjoyed hearing you say that I digested the material, because it really feels like that's what I did. It was a very apt description, even though I don't know if it was planned.
It was a mistake on my part, but I just realized it must have been fun digesting all of that stuff and finding it for the first time, I guess.
Well, that's it. It kind of felt like a jewel had been entrusted to me, is really what it felt like. In 2000... the CBC radio went on a nationwide initiative to have all of their holdings at all of the provincial archives across Canada digitized, because I guess the Ontario Archive, the Manitoba Archive, the BC Archives, the Territorial Archives had accumulated a lot of material over the years. And so I was hired to be a audio preservationist to help digitize the holdings at the BC Archives that belonged to the CBC. And about 8 months into working there, the Orchard Collection came my way, and it was my task over the next 4 years to listen to and digitize and catalog that collection. And, it really felt like a jewel had been entrusted to me.
So tell us who Imbert Orchard was and why he did this.
Yeah, it's a great story, actually. Imbert Orchard was a CBC TV and radio producer. And in 1959, he produced a TV show on the Klondike Gold Rush. And the day after it aired, an elderly woman from Hazelton named Constance Cox walked into his office and said, "I saw the program you made on the Klondike. You got the whole thing wrong. I was there. This is how it happened." And so he was so fascinated with the stories that she had to share with him that he borrowed his secretary's tape recorder and proceeded to record, I think, 9 hours of interviews with her. And two of the stories from that initial session have actually been included in this book, and you can hear them. And he got this great idea to go up to the Skeena River area, like around Hazelton, and do some more recordings. So he asked for a budget from the CBC to do this. And he's provided with a sound technician, a fellow named Ian Stephen. And Orchard and Stephen spent the next 6 years, so, from 1959 to 1966, going all over the province by all means, pack horses, trains, planes, walking, whatever they needed to do, boats, to go into communities and start interviewing the elders of the community. And, as much as he wanted to use some of this for radio broadcasts, and he did in the 60s and early 70s, some of it was broadcast. In his words, he knew that what he was doing was going to preserve the story of the country. Mm-hmm. And so that was ample justification for him to just keep getting budgets to go out into the field and record these people. And, as you mentioned in your introduction, he interviewed 998 people from 1959 to 66, 2,700 hours of raw material. And it's, it's a treasure. It's one of the largest oral history collections in the world.
And so when you're sitting in the archive there with the earphones over your ears, listening to this stuff for the first time, it must have been cool to get transported to years and years ago.
Well, that's exactly what it felt like. I mean, I would put the headphones on, and I'd close my eyes. I'd have to open them in order to do descriptions of what it was that I was listening to, but there'd be periods of time where I would close my eyes, and I'd be listening to these stories of these people relating what their lives were like in the 1800s and around the turn of the century. And, yeah, I mean, transported is the right word. I felt like I was right there along in the journey. I mean, there's so much emotion and subtlety that is communicated in these people's voices that, you know, using your empathy is really, really easy, which to me is why I felt it necessary to make sure that we included CDs along with the book. You need to listen to these people's stories to really get the gist of the atmosphere of the times, and, you know, they do it brilliantly.
Mm-hmm. So there are three CDs in here, and so people can read along as they listen to them.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, I mean, I kind of feel like my job is to be the tour guide. So what I've done is I've provided photos and maps and little bits of context so that anybody who knows nothing about BC history should be able to read a bit of context, situate themselves with the map, and have a bit of a visual with the photos to then be able to get the gist of what the story is. You know, a little bit of context just to situate you, and then, you know, let the people's words speak for themselves, because they do. They really, really do.
Now, Mr. Stephen, his engineer, he died a couple years ago. Is that correct?
He did. He died 2 years ago, and that's actually a really fun. There's a fun story with that too. There was a very, very long time that I went on a search to find this guy, and for various reasons, in a joking way, whenever Orchard would write down his name, he spelled it E A N instead of I A N, Ian. Mm-hmm. And so I was constantly looking for this guy, Ian Stephen. And I put out the word to so many people, does anyone know what happened to him? And, you know, it came back to me, yeah, he died in the 70s, you know, is kind of what I was told. And 3 days before Voices of British Columbia was supposed to go out to press, I got a call from CBC archivist Colin Preston saying, hey, I found Ian Stephen. He's alive and well in Campbell River. Here's his phone number. So I called him, and he said, hey, everyone calls you Lucky, don't they? I said, yeah. And he said, well, I've read your thesis. I've been following your work. Man, you're spot on with the work that we've done. Huh. And I said, can I come to Campbell River and can I interview you? And he said, yeah, you better come quick. I'm going to be 80 soon. You better get up here. So I traveled up to Campbell River to speak to this man whose work I had immersed myself in. And it kind of felt like meeting a long-lost uncle. And, you know, we were able to discuss, you know, the journey that he and Orchard took over those years. And, you know, I had a lot of questions, and he was able to answer a lot of them for me. And, yeah, I mean, and for him, the fact that his work was being recognized after being so long forgotten was, you know, it meant a lot to him near the end of his life. It brought him a lot of joy. So it was a great meeting. It was a great relationship. I feel very lucky that I was able to do that.
Yeah. Now, did you get any insight from him as to how Orchard worked in terms of how he found these people and what sort of preparation he did and how the interviews were conducted?
Absolutely. So what Orchard would do is he would go into a community and he would go to, you know, the local garage or the library. He would just start asking around, you know, who are the old-timers? Who are the people who can tell me the stories? And, you know, one thing would lead to another, and someone would say, oh, you should talk to this guy, you should talk to that girl, you should talk to this person, that person. And he would go, and he would have a quick meeting, and he always said the first rule for doing this kind of work is people have to want to talk to you. Mm. So he would talk to people and find out, yeah, they've got some stories or they don't. And then he would set up a time to come back with Ian Stephen to do some recording. And they would set up in the person's house, and Ian and Orchard pioneered a new way of recording in the early 60s, where the interviewee would be given a little wire that would hang around their neck that the microphone would attach to. Now, this was before the invention of lapel microphones. Mm. So it basically served as a lapel microphone. And so, you know, they would hook this contraption up, and then they would just go. And I think one of the reasons why the recording sounds so beautiful is because, you know, the microphone and the recording of the time was done so delicately and so well that you really do feel like you're in the room with these people. So after figuring out who the people were, who they would talk to, they would sit down and they would talk, and they would just let the let the recordings go. And some interviews are only a half hour long, and I think the longest one in there is 26 hours of material over the course of a couple of years. I kept going back to talk to this one gentleman, Martin Starrett. And it runs the gamut, you know.
And as a historian, Lucky, what do we get from these oral histories that we haven't had from, say, traditional history books? I mean, you really do get a sense, don't you, of the character of British Columbia?
Well, I think that's the main thing. Not just the character and the characters, but a lot of the subtlety of what was happening on the ground. I mean, the way that BC history, in my opinion, has hitherto been conceptualized only has a handful of characters and a lot of facts. You know, the railway was built in the 1880s and, you know, and how that goes. But what you get from this collection is the people actually doing the work, the success stories and the failures, and their perspective on what it was like. I mean, there are so many subtleties that are put into the mix. Let me give you an example. Mm-hmm. In that first interview that he did with Cox that I mentioned earlier, She talks about an experience that her uncle had with a woman named Josephine who ran the dance hall in Barkerville in 1859, 1860. Now, we don't know anything about this woman's last name or anything else about her, just the fact that she was miserable with the winters in Barkerville. Now, traditionally, when you read about Barkerville, we all know that it was a gold mining town, and we think about gold miners, and we think about fortunes won and lost, and that kind of thing. But the story that Cox shares with us is about how her uncle fulfilled this woman Josephine's dying wish of having her body transported all the way back from Barkerville to San Francisco. And it took something like 6 to 8 months for the body to get back there, and he incurred a debt of $30,000 to do it. So what we have embedded in the narrative is stories of camaraderie and compassion and sticking together and how remote a place like Barkerville really, really was back at the time that it was, you know, the largest settlement north of San Francisco in the world. And so it's all those little subtleties that are communicated, that is the essence of what you get from storytelling. I mean, the facts are embedded in the narrative, but what you get are all these little subtle plot lines that can really help paint a picture of the atmosphere. So even though it's a story about this woman who didn't like the winters, we learn so much more about what life was like and what people had to go through and how they had to come together that you just don't get from a traditional history.
And just imagine what would have been lost if Orchard hadn't done this work.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's astounding. I mean, we're so lucky that the recording technology was available to us in British Columbia around this time that he could go and do this work. I mean, you know, the changes that happened in a place like Ontario from the 1600s right up through the 1800s as far as infrastructure and non-native immigration. It happened over the course of a couple hundred years out east. It was all truncated and happened so quickly in British Columbia in a span of about 30 years because as of 1858, January 1858, there was only about 100 or 150 non-native people living in what is all of British Columbia. And there were 30,000 by the end of that year and nearly 400,000 by the First World War. So because this happened so quickly and, you know, people's memories were still intact, you know, in the late 50s and early 60s, we actually do get a perspective on this history that you just couldn't get in any other part of the world. And thankfully, he went and he recorded it. And thankfully, the BC Archives acquired the tapes. And thankfully, they brought me on board, and I can help, you know, shed some light on this material because it's really important for our understanding of, you know, the history of our province.
So after 1966, did Orchard do any more of these oral histories? Did anyone succeed him in doing that? I mean, is someone doing that sort of stuff today?
Well, you know, there are other pockets of people doing other things. You know, if you go into the archives, you know, there's a lot of people that have gone out and interviewed survivors, for example, of Japanese internment camps or, you know, the history of Chinatowns and that kind of stuff. But on a scale like he did, absolutely not. But fortunately, people, you know, are taking on the mantle and doing it. And in fact, you know, I've started my business, Memories to Memoirs, based on the work that Orchard did. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I get hired by families to interview and record family members and help them bring some form to their lives and write memoirs. So, I mean, but has anyone really picked up the mantle? Not in the way that Orchard did, that's for sure.
And
not even close.
Yeah, and I read in the book that you and Cheryl when she plays some of this stuff on North by Northwest. You guys hear back from people, family members, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, the way that I got really, really turned on to the material in the first place was that one week into listening to this collection, I saw some tapes that were titled Patinaud Horsefly. And my best friend at the time, who is still one of my closest friends, is a woman named Ferris Patinaud from Horsefly, who is fifth generation. Her family was one of the first non-native settlers to settle in the Cariboo. And there was tapes with her great-great-grandfather and her great-great-uncle. And it hit me that day. Oh, my goodness. These are stories about places that people know and are familiar with mm-hmm. in a language that they can understand about their history. Like, wow, this is really, really important material. I mean, for my own family, not that they were even recorded, but had they been recorded, the language would have been some Central European dialect that I wouldn't be able to understand, and I wouldn't have been able to relate to a lot of what they were talking about just because I'm no longer, I'm not familiar that, with Central European history mm-hmm. and landscapes. So it hit me right away that what we have in this collection are, the descendants of the people who are recorded here all around us and everywhere. So when this material gets played, yeah, we'll get phone calls from people saying, hey, I had this amazing one, actually. This woman who was saying, I was driving down the Sea to Sky Highway, and I heard the voice of my grandfather, who died in 1968. I hadn't heard his voice in nearly 50 years. And I had no idea, and I had to pull over because tears were streaming down my face. Thank you so much for playing this. Where do I get the tapes? And, the answer is, well, the tapes are all in the BC archives. And, but we get lots of other stories, too. Like, this landmark near the BC-Alberta border is called Fuse Mountain. Well, I have a recording with Edward Fuse, the gentleman who, the story is about. Like, oh, now that I know this story, that landmark means so much more to me. Someone will email me. And there's so many stories like that. It's a real treasure, I used to liken my job to Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, like you'd crack open one of these tapes and it would really feel like, 1 in 3, 1 in 4, even 1 in 2 had a golden ticket. There was something in those stories that was going to blow my mind. And they did.
I was going to ask you, Lucky, what compelled you to go into a life of history? But I guess you've already answered that, haven't you? I mean,
it felt like something I had to do. It wasn't really a question. I mean, I was getting an education on the history of the province that nobody else would ever have by listening to this material. And I took it on. I mean, it was just, this is what I had to do. I have to get this material out to people. It would be unconscionable for it just to sit in archives, with only a handful of people knowing about it. I mean, it's a treasure, and it needed to be treated as such, and it just felt like my link in the chain was to get it out there, and hopefully people will be still interested in this material hundreds of years from now, because it's an important part of our province, and in our history and understanding ourselves ultimately. And the fun thing about British Columbia is that there's so many different ecosystems and pockets mm-hmm. that a story you'll hear from someone in the Cariboo is completely different than someone you'll hear from the Okanagan or the Arrow Lakes or the coast. And fortunately for us, Orchard and Stephen ran the gamut. They have all of it. So there's so many different, perspectives, ideas, stories in this material.
So other than the business that you have, memories to memoirs, and then writing books like this, you also write with Roy Henry Vickers. What have you got? What else are you guys working on? I know that you've got another
I'm
book.
I'm currently working on a book. Featuring a bunch of works of Ted Harrison, who's also a prominent Canadian artist, which has been a real pleasure. And I've got some other books in the works and some other projects, and there's also the CBC radio series. But more than anything, I fashion myself a full-time dad. I have a one-year-old girl and a three-year-old boy, and I work from home. I'm talking to you right now from my home office, of which I've closed the door for a little bit to have this conversation. But I'm a full-time dad. I'm with my kids all the time, and I've built my lifestyle with all the work that I do and everything around being able to be here to be with my kids while they're so little. And that's ultimately, of all the pleasures in my life, that's among the highest.
So what should we do with our own histories? I mean, we have Facebook, we have Twitter, we have Instagram. Is that enough, do you think, in terms of chronicling one's life or keeping track of it all?
Yeah, you know, I don't really think so. I mean, I fashion myself as an oral historian, and as an oral historian, I believe that I work within the medium of storytelling. And I really think that the more detailed story, or the more we learn from just telling stories and passing them on, this is an ancient thing that people have been doing for thousands and thousands and thousands of years, passing down stories. I think, you know, chronicling them somewhat by basis of things like Facebook to tell other people is one thing, but, you know, I mean, I think the more you tell your story, the more you're in touch with your own life, and the more you can share knowledge with future generations, and ultimately, you know, realistically, with your kids, you know, and the more you can tell them about yourself, it seems like the more people are interested. And my experience with the success of the books that I'm doing is ample justification and ample, you know, it goes to show that people really are interested in stories as a medium of communicating knowledge and history, and that's ultimately what I'm trying to help do. And it's not original. I'm not, you know, it's like this is what people have been doing since well before written history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and well, I'll let you get back to the more important job of being a dad, but as a historian, this is a very fine achievement, this book, Echoes of British Columbia. It's a great service for all of us, and I'm sure for future generations. Congratulations on it, and good luck with it.
Thank you. I really appreciate it, and I hope that your listeners, whoever they may be at any particular time, will listen to some of the stuff, and it'll encourage them to search their own archives or even their own histories of their own lives to continue doing the work of, you know, getting our stories recorded, getting them out there, and helping us all to learn more, because, I mean, there's a lot of stories still to be told. It's very exciting.
Absolutely, yeah. The website for more memories to memoirs.ca. The book is called Echoes of British Columbia, Voices from the Frontier. It's from Harbor Publishing. Its author, Lucky Budd, joined me on the line from Victoria, British Columbia, in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.